Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
In a culture that venerates youthfulness, midlife gets a bad rap. To be young, we believe, is to be beautiful, creative, energetic, and full of potential. Middle age is the stage we associate with paunch, weariness, and a resigned slide down the hill of the rest of our lives. No wonder people have midlife crises, right? Except we mostly don't. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty experienced some big changes in midlife, but discovered many of them came with rewards. And she set out to speak with experts about everything from the potential for better-than-ever relationships, more satisfaction at work, and the unique brilliance of the middle-aged brain. Really. You probably remember her from nearly 20 years as a correspondent for NPR. She also reported early in her career for the Christian Science Monitor. Her new book is called Life Reimagined: The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Barbara, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You had a pretty serious health scare when you were 53, and you realized there was this disconnect between your 30-something self-image and your 50-something reality.
Yes, I certainly did. It was actually in the afternoon, a September day, and I had received a particularly unhappy email from a listener who had heard a piece of mine on All Things Considered the day before, which is enough to send anyone into feelings of having a heart attack. And basically, that's what happened. You know, I began to feel my heart pound and get short of breath and felt a heat radiating up my back. And I called my doctor, and while I was talking to him, I fainted. And suddenly I found myself in the ER. And actually, by the time I got to the ER, I was feeling pretty good. You know, I recovered a lot in the ambulance, and I felt I'm in good shape. I was a spin, you know, I spin every day and all of that. And so I was trying to argue myself out of the ER when the nurse who was tending to me looked at my chart and said, "You're 53, right?" And I said, "Yes," as if it were a clinical condition, right, being middle-aged. And she said, "I think we're going to keep you overnight." And what happened that night is that my father died. He was 91, and there I was stuck in the hospital, and I really couldn't get out. I finally did a few hours later. But it hit me really hard that moment, that morning at 5 in the morning, when my dad died and I had had a health scare, that kind of my brothers in my generation was the first to go, and or the next, excuse me, the next to go.
Yeah.
And so I really had to kind of think, how do I want to live the rest of my life? I mean, I don't have an infinite amount of time. And do the old rules, the old tricks, do they still work now that I'm middle-aged as opposed to 25 or 35? And that really got me thinking about how I want to live this chapter of my life.
What did you learn about the U-shaped curve of human happiness?
Yeah, well, let me first, the good news is that very, very few people have a midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. Only about 10% of people have this existential angst that they are going to die without achieving their dreams or hopes and aspirations. But something, I mean, the U-shaped happiness curve is almost universal. What happens is the economists for the past 20 years have taken surveys of people in 75 different countries, and they've asked them, are you happy? And what they find is this U-shaped curve. So people in their 20s are very happy, in their 30s a little less happy, in their 40s and 50s they're not very happy at all, early 50s. And then they begin swooping back up that U-curve in their late 50s and 60s and 70s. And so what is, if midlife crisis isn't all that common, midlife ennui is really, really universal. And it's, basically, it's not surprising that we have some kind of ennui because it's a burdened, difficult, it's a complicated time, right? It's not, you're not going out drinking with friends at night as you might have in your 20s. You have kids and maybe aging parents, and you have responsibilities at work and a mortgage and college tuition and all that stuff. And what that means is that people aren't giddy with happiness, but what they are is they feel like they have a meaningful life. And so there's kind of two sides to this U-shaped happiness curve. One is, yeah, we aren't giddy. We aren't, you know, dancing on the tabletops. But on the other hand, we're investing in the things that really matter, our kids and our careers, and that creates real meaning in our lives.
So we all say we want happiness, which is easily confused with pleasure. Your conclusion is that we're better off seeking eudaimonia, which, despite the name, is not a psychotropic medication.
Yes, no, it isn't. Actually, this was a word that Aristotle used a lot. And eudaimonia is this idea of... it's the opposite of hedonism, or, you know, having a good glass of wine, or, you know, going to a baseball game and having fun in the moment. Eudaimonia is a sense of investing long-term, striving for long-term goals. So it could be raising terrific kids, or it could be training for a marathon, or it can be, you know, staying up late and getting that work done that you need to get done for kind of an investment in the future. So what Aristotle says is that you, and others too, modern researchers also say this, is that eudaimonia is, it may not be, again, happy in the moment, but it is meaningful long term, and eventually it brings you happiness in the moment. It also is really, really good for you biologically. Mm-hmm. It turns out that having kind of purpose in life is really, it staves off, people who are high in purpose in life are much less likely to have heart attacks or stroke. They're more likely to keep their memories intact. They're more likely to escape the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, even though they may have Alzheimer's disease. So eudaimonia is a really, really good bet. It's a bet on the long term.
So what gives us a sense that our lives have meaning?
Well, you know, it can be large or small. So it can be something as major as, gosh, you know, my kids give me meaning, my grandkids give me meaning, investing in the next generation. It can be investing, it's often investing outward, so investing in a cause or caring about a political campaign. It can be just doing a really good job at work and building up a career. But it can also be really small stuff, which is kind of what I found. I mean, I have large stuff too, but I found a real happiness in coming up with small goals. So, for example, if I can just tell you one anecdote, back in 2012, I could barely walk up a flight of stairs because I had arthritis in my right knee. And I began spinning and biking just kind of to keep myself in shape. And then I interviewed someone who had qualified and was competing in the Senior Games, which is a national competition for athletes 50 and older. And he challenged me to see if I could qualify and cycle in the 2015 games. Well, suddenly I had this little goal, right? I had a reason. I had little victories. You know, I'm going to do a 50-mile ride today, or I'm going to do intervals today. I'm going to practice. And it wasn't fun in the moment, but it gave me something to work toward. So here was a little tiny purpose that gave me enormous fun and got me out of bed in the morning. You know, someone said something to me that I thought was really the perfect metaphor for midlife. It's a woman named Kathy Utzschneider, and she trains a lot of middle-aged elite athletes. And she says, you know, when you're young, there are a lot of markers in life. You graduate from college, you maybe get married, you have kids, you launch a career, and then you hit midlife. And midlife goes on and on and on with very few markers, right? She says it's kind of like a book with no punctuation, just a lot of words, but where are the paragraphs or the semicolons or the periods? Having goals, little purpose, big goals, little goals, that gives punctuation back to your midlife. And that's what I found happened to me.
Cycling can be dangerous. At one point, you had a bad fall.
Yes, and that led me into my resilience chapter. Yeah, I had just accepted the challenge from Mike Adsit, the fellow who challenged me to try to compete in the Senior Games, and at his with his encouragement, I bought a new bike, and 2 days later, hit a pothole and broke my collarbone. And what was really funny about that, it wasn't actually all that funny, but what was ironic about that was that just a few days earlier, I'd gone up to Philadelphia where I was watching Army soldiers being trained in the art of resilience by some University of Pennsylvania researchers. And what I realized is that this was a perfect chance for me to really try to understand what it is about resilience. And there's a couple of really kind of wonderful things to know about resilience. First, we are so much more resilient than we think we are. The studies show that people who have really terrible things happen to them, spinal cord injuries, even losing a child, but losing a parent, all sorts of things, those people tend to return to their set point relatively soon. And so what that means is that we are a lot more bouncy. We're a lot more resilient than what we would ever, you know, ever imagine. The other thing I learned, and this is a phrase that resilience researchers use, OPM, other people matter. So what I found is that because I needed other people to help me, I mean, literally, like, I couldn't shower or dry my hair. I kind of looked like Felix the cat after my husband had had finished with the hairdryer, you know, but I relied on other people to help me. And people who do that recover a lot more quickly from setbacks.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty. You know her from nearly 20 years as a correspondent for NPR. Her new book is called Life Reimagined: The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty. Her new book is called Life Reimagined: The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Barbara, the past couple of years, every once in a while, I will want to think of someone's name or a word, and it'll just take me a second. And that never used to happen. And we all, as we get older, start to have these little lapses, and it's never, you can never quite be sure if you should be worried about this or if it's what happens.
Right, right, right. The other day I was walking, looking frantically for my cell phone when I realized that I was actually talking on it. I don't know if that's happened to you, but it happens to me more often than I would like to admit. You know, here's the good news. I mean, everyone is different, and obviously some people, if they're forgetting things, this may be an indication of something bad going on. But most people in middle age forget things. And what the really good news is that we're actually operating at our peak capacity intellectually. And let me tell you why. There are kind of two types of intelligence. One is called fluid intelligence. It's the ability to solve novel problems, like, you know, like Sherlock Holmes, right? And that intelligence begins to decrease after about age 30. You slow down. Your processing
30.
Speed slows down. Right. After 30, isn't that horrible? I know. I was quite distressed to learn this. But then I learned the good news. And the good news is there's another type of intelligence called crystallized intelligence. And that's all the stuff you learn in life. It's what you learn in school. It's your vocabulary. It's reading the New York Times. It's your wisdom. It's your expertise. It's your ability to put on a radio program much better now than you could when you first started, right? Those are the kinds of things. That's crystallized intelligence. And that increases right into your 70s. So what happens when you're in your like early 50s, is you're at your peak operating capacity because your fluid intelligence and your processing speed has not decreased very much, but your crystallized intelligence, your expertise and wisdom, that has really increased a lot. And it's why, for example, when you're looking for a surgeon, you want a 50-year-old surgeon and not a 30-year-old surgeon, because the 50-year-old has seen this before, knows that when something goes wrong, he or she can look at the situation and go, you know what, I know what to do now. Whereas a 30-year-old might not.
So a lot of people hear about these programs that promise to keep your brain sharp, and you pay money and you do these quizzes. You tried some of these. The jury is out among scientists, but what did you learn?
Well, I didn't do Lumosity or one of these commercial programs. What I did is I worked with two scientists who are really changing the way we think about IQ. And these researchers were at the time at the University of Maryland. So what I did is I went over there to Maryland and I took a battery of cognitive tests that test my fluid intelligence. And I got to say, it was like torture. It was horrible. I hate standardized tests. I felt like, you know, they were pulling my fingernails out while I was trying to figure out all these, you know, novel problems. And I went home and they gave me a computer program called an NBAC, which is basically something to help your working memory. It's your ability to to juggle like words or numbers in your head. So reading is working memory because you have to remember what you read at the beginning of the sentence when you get to the end of the sentence to give it meaning, right? So this is supposed to, you know, increase my working intelligence and maybe my fluid intelligence. Well, I went back 30 days later, and lo and behold, as I was taking these torturous, horrible tests a second time, I realized that it was as if time were slowing down. It was as if I had more time to do each problem. And I improved on the critical test of fluid intelligence by 75%. So it was, I mean, it was actually ridiculous how much I improved. And that probably is not just the retest effect, where I was a little bit more familiar with the test the second time. There was probably some improvement. But here's the good news, Chris. You don't have to sit in front of a computer. In fact, researchers say you probably shouldn't sit in front of a computer and do these brain training games to help your brain. What you should do is engage in something that is challenging, novel maybe, and interesting to you. So, you know, learn how to play the guitar, or brush off your Spanish lessons and, you know, take Spanish again, or learn digital photography, or go to the museum. All of this stuff increases your intelligence, your crystallized intelligence, and it keeps your brain sharp. So the good news is there is stuff that we can do right to our dying breath, really, that keeps us sharp.
So there might be people in midlife who wish they could go back to their 30s or even their 20s. Very few people would go back to their childhoods or certainly their teenage years. But you say there's something about the way people under 18 move through life and learn that we can all go back to and learn from.
Yeah, you know, that's true. And this really relates to what we were just talking about. I mean, kids, they try and they fail and they try and they fail. So the reason that kids are so good at learning a new language, it's partly a brain issue. You know, it's partly that there are more connections and, you know, their synapses are firing faster and they have, you know, better memories and all of that. But it's also because they really spend time, you know, studying that language or studying guitar or whatever. They try and try and try and fail and fail and fail until they get it. Whereas an adult would be like, you know, gosh, I can try this a few times, but I have bills to pay. You know, I've got like a life to live. And so what we find is that people who are really good, who are very disciplined about continuously training, like, you know, chess players or pianists who are in middle-aged and they actually practice with this deliberate practice, the kind of practice that kids do, those people do very, very well. They're basically as good, just about as good as young musicians, young guitar players or young pianists or young chess players. They can perform almost as well. Even though their processing speed is slower, they're doing the practice. So if you don't give up, if you learn like a child and just plow through, you will sharpen your brain and you'll learn Spanish in the process.
You know, midlife is an easy time to let relationships slide because, as you mentioned, people are really pulled between career and maybe aging parents and young children. Romantic relationships can slide, but platonic ones can too.
Yes.
First of all, let's talk about what can interfere with platonic friendships at this stage of life.
Well, basically life. I mean, you know, like when you're in your 20s or whatever, before you're married or before you have a partner, you have time for your friends. But then you may get married or you have a partner and you begin to have kids and you have a more demanding career. And maybe you have things like, you know, aging parents or whatever. The first thing to go is your friends. That's the first thing that gets dropped. The problem is that's one of the worst things you can do because friends are unique in the way you can offload your stress to your friends. So there have actually been studies, brain studies. I actually did one holding the hand of a friend. And what you find is that when you're facing challenges alone, your fear centers, you know, when you are faced with a threat, your fear centers go crazy. But when you are facing a challenge with a friend, your brain is much quieter. And what it means is that your whole body down-regulates. Your immune system is boosted. You know, your body repairs skins. It maintains blood vessels and tissues. You live longer. You recover faster from cancer. All of this is shown by studies showing that people with networks of friends fare much better in life. And the reason is, like, for example, I have a friend named Jody Hassett, and she's a news reporter I worked for CNN and ABC News, and we would get together on a regular basis and talk about our issues at work. You know, okay, I'm doing this story, and I don't know how to get to this source, and how do I do this X, Y, and Z? We would offload our problems to each other, come up with solutions. And as wonderful as my husband is, he's a political scientist, right? He's not going to be able to help me figure this stuff out. So that's what friends do. They help, they share the burden of life with you, and they make life better.
We do expect a lot of our life partners, and it's almost impossible for anybody to measure up to the ideal that we've created for, you know, our spouses.
Yeah, no, it really is. You know, it's the marriage research is pretty difficult, partly because most people don't really look at marriages over the long term. But there have been a few studies that looked at couples as they proceeded from, you know, early marriage or right before marriage, right for 20 years or so. And what they find is that there are a few things that really happy couples do. One of them, here's a really interesting piece of a little factoid. Usually, the kind of the what you hear over and over again in marriage researchers is research is opposites attract, then they attack, right? But that actually isn't true in midlife. In midlife, it's about getting stuff done. It's about the carpool and the jobs and the parents and all this other stuff, right? And so people in midlife do very well when they are very different, an introvert or an extrovert, a conscientious person and someone who's, you know, a little bit more social, that kind of thing. Those people do really, really well. The other thing that's really key, and I need to learn this in my marriage. I was married late at age 43, and I'm still bad at this. but the couples that seem to do well and didn't get divorced and were really happy after 20 years used plural pronouns. They used we and us rather than I and me. And obviously, this wasn't a matter of semantics. It was a mindset, right? People who face, this is what we're talking about with friends, people who face the world together, face challenges together, people who are a team, those people are much happier throughout their marriage than those who really are very, very independent, which is hard for someone like me, you know, who was very independent for the first 43 years of my life. And I'm having to learn how to play as a teammate, you know. But there are, you know, there are things that we can do to make marriage last. And I mean, it's actually kind of sad because right now we're in a bit of a marriage crisis. It's called the Gray Divorce Revolution, where we are baby boomers and Gen Xers are kind of divorcing at record rates, much higher than their parents ever did. And so it's good to know that there may be some things that we can do to try to keep that middle-age marriage going.
All right, let's hold that for just a moment. We'll take a quick break here. My guest is journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty. We're talking about her book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She spent nearly 20 years as a correspondent for NPR, and she has a new book out called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. So, Barbara, to keep your marriage exciting, you and your husband pursued novel experiences together. You rented an RV and toured the country. And what I loved about this story was that it wasn't like everything was perfect.
No, it was kind of the RV trip from heck, if we can say. We're public radio, so we can't. It was a really, really funny trip. My husband Devin and I rented this RV. We were joined by two friends who are lawyers. So it was, you know, a PhD, two lawyers, and an NPR reporter, plus my dog, our dog, who's a yellow lab named Sandra Day, right? So we had, the five of us went down the Blue Ridge Parkway. Unfortunately, we picked the rainiest June on record in the southeastern United States. I mean, it poured every single day. But I have to tell you, Chris, we had the time of our lives. We really did. And the reason was because of novelty. I had never driven, no one had ever driven an RV before. We didn't know how to make the stuff. We didn't know how to, you know, drain the black water, and let's not talk about that. But, you know, we ended up getting flooded. Our brakes almost went out. We got stuck on a number of occasions. We couldn't get out of our park on a number of occasions. I mean, it was a crazy time. It was a rainy time, and it was a blast. It was a blast because it was all so new. We had to kind of adjust, and we had to try to figure out things that we hadn't done before. And it was just, it pushed out our boundaries, and we had a blast.
I've been so interested. I don't know if you're familiar with David Eagleman's research that finds that when you're doing something brand new, time seems to last longer. It's almost like you make your life last longer.
Yes. You know, I have found that. I've found that as well. And it did seem like a really long trip. But we're going to do it again. But, you know, that actually relates to something that I found in my own research. I came up with a couple of themes. I noticed a couple of themes. And one of them was, it's tangentially related, one of them is this idea that autopilot is death. Hmm. And what I mean by that is when you start doing things on rote, you know, procedurally, when you start taking things for granted, when you don't mix up your life, when you take your career for granted, or your husband for granted, or wife for granted, whatever, your kids, your health, whatever, that prompts a serious funk. That's what I found, that people who were taking things for granted were not all that happy. But the people who really engaged in life, invested in those things that were really important, the people for whom autopilot was non-existent, those people seem to be really, really happy. And it's a little bit related to what you just said. I mean, life is more exciting when you're actually investing in it, investing in those things that are important.
I have to imagine it was easy for you to take your voice for granted until you had problems.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, yes, that was a big deal for me. My brother has this as well. He's had 12 vocal cord surgeries. I haven't had any surgeries, but in 2012, I began getting chronic pain in my vocal cords, and I would lose my voice for days or weeks at a time. And that's hard for a radio reporter, to say the least. And what it did, it was actually one of the drivers for my getting a book contract, because I found that the stress of deadlines really seemed to exacerbate the pain. Mm. So I got a book contract looking at midlife, because, you know, bad stuff happens in midlife, right? I mean, we're more likely to, you know, for a parent to die or for you to get cancer or something. Bad stuff seems to cluster. Bad things seem to cluster in midlife. Well, what I did is I really tried to look hard at what my life was like and the stresses in my life. And what I found was when I really reduced the stress, the pain reduced dramatically. I also did a little bit of research on placebos and pain. And what I really found, this was another thing I found in my another theme, but your thinking is your experience. What I found, and this is very true, researchers say, that pain is very susceptible to thought, to the way you think about it. And so if you can strip the emotional part of the pain away, if you know that you get migraines and you feel one coming on, it's not just the actual pain of the migraine that makes it hurt. It's also the emotion of, oh my gosh, I'm getting a migraine. I'm going to be like out of commission for 2 days. Oh, this is awful. There's that emotional overlay that makes it worse. And when I was able to kind of strip away some of that emotional overlay, like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I'll be able to speak. How will I ever get the peace on All Things Considered today? When I was able to take that away, the stress reduced and the pain reduced dramatically. It was really an eye-opener for me.
What did you learn about the dangers but also the benefits of occupation as identity?
Yeah, boy, I mean, with a lot of midlife folks, you know, we're we've been in our careers for 20, 30 years or so, and it's really become a part of our identity. Here's the problem. It's a really startling statistic. Gallup has been surveying people for a long time, since 2000. And what they have found is that only a third of midlifers are actually engaged in their work. And fully, almost one in five midlifers are actively disengaged. And that is a really, really bad thing, because disengagement, being unhappy at work, brings all sorts of terrible things to your body. I mean, people who are disengaged are more likely to report stress and physical pain. They'll have higher stress levels, cortisol, higher blood pressure, more likely to have depression, you know, or call in sick. It's really, really bad to be unhappy with your work. And because so many people identify with their work, I mean, that can really affect their entire lives. So what I kind of looked at, there's kind of a good piece of news here, though. And it has to do with, we'd already talked about purpose in life, but this has to do with purpose in work. The Danes have, in Denmark, they have surveyed people. And what they have found, a lot of 2,600 employees at length, and what they found was the most important thing contributing to job satisfaction is feeling that your work has purpose. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
That either if your job, like your job has a real meaning and purpose to it, or that you are part of an organization like NPR, like KERA, that has purpose, you are far, far more likely to be happy in your job, more likely to be happy in your job. It's more important than, say, having good leadership or good work-life balance or you know, high achievements and a lot of praise at work. It is really, really important. So if people can, who are a little bit perplexed about what's happening to their career, if they can think through, how can I have more purpose in my life? How can I major on the things, stress the things that I'm really good at, and maybe do fewer of the things I'm not as good at? I mean, this takes a lot of effort. It takes self-knowledge, but it also takes a conversation with your boss, too, or rethinking your career altogether. But if you can kind of rethink what is important to me, what do I think is important for the world, what can I do that will get me out of bed every morning and feel like I'm really making a contribution? That's very, very important. And it's even more important because we can't retire at 60 or 65 the way our parents could. We're probably going to have to work until 70 or something. And anyway, who wants to play golf for 30 years, right? I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
And so we have to think about, what do you want to do for the next 15, 20 years? What makes life meaningful? And that's why people need to rethink their career at midlife.
So I don't fear old age because, perhaps naively, I have the example of my grandmother who lived to be 90 and was very physically and socially active and was just really a lot of fun and made it seem like a fearless thing to do to get old. You have your mother, and she seems like just a fantastic role model for you.
Oh, she is amazing. My mom reads the New York Times. She's 94. Mm-hmm. She reads the New York Times and the Washington Post cover to cover every single day. I never argue with her about foreign affairs because she always has a more nuanced argument. Uh-huh. There are a few debates I win with my mom. Mom is really engaged. Mom is not on autopilot. She cares about people. And she cares about ideas. And, one of the keys to really good successful aging, the researchers say, is that what happens is people who are successful at midlife and older, they do two things really well. They care about people. They focus on people that are close to them. So they quit worrying so much about whether they have, a larger house or a more expensive car or more kudos at work or a higher salary. They start to focus on people because relationships are vital. The other thing they focus on are causes. Things that they believe are really important. So it could be your church or synagogue. It could be a political campaign. It could be your community. But people who make that shift toward those more lasting values, people and causes, those people are really happy. And that's what my mom did. Mom was very involved in church, and she loves other people and was always interested, not only in her own friends, but in my brothers and my friends, too. She's kind of a mascot for us all.
Journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty spent nearly 20 years as a correspondent for NPR. Her new book is called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Barbara, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Oh, Chris, it's been really fun. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington.